Hi, I'm Emily, and I'm about to have dinner in Old Town, and you're listening to Outside the Loop, Chicago's almost above ground audio magazine.
Yeah, dinner sounds good. It's Valentine's Day coming up, after all. Come on now. Good morning, and welcome to Outside the Loop. Yes, this is Chicago's almost above ground audio magazine. I am Mike Steven. It is great to be here with you today for show number 904. And what we do here on this program is take a look at local issues and topics that don't always get mainstream media attention. Bob Ferguson is our engineer on duty today in the WGN radio studios. And we love Bob. And look, it's that time of year. Love is everywhere. It's Valentine's Day coming up. I know it's not until this Wednesday, but is this something that's being celebrated the weekend before? Apparently so, since my email inbox is flooded with special Valentine's Day menus from local restaurants and discounts for things like picture frames and flowers. Now, I'm not one of these anti-Valentine's Day people. Sure, it's a contrived holiday. Not sure if holiday is the right term here, but you know what I mean. But if there is a day that is dedicated to love, well, then sure, that sounds great to me. I mean, have you looked at the news lately? Love seems to be in short supply these days. Yes, there are anti-Valentine's Day events. For example, you could attend a local anti-V-Day brunch or hit up one of the many bar nights that are dedicated to being in opposition to this quote-unquote holiday. There's even a mini film festival at the Salt Shed next Wednesday through Friday called Crying at the Shed, and it features all tearjerker movies. The National Mexican Museum of Art in Pilsen has an anti-Valentine's Day event, and even the infamous bar in the Gold Coast, The Hang-Up, has an event this week with the same theme, which is ironic since that bar is responsible for the beginning of many relationships and many poor decisions. So look, I offer some love this Valentine's Day season. Love to the city leaders who sometimes like to work and get the people's business done, who sometimes like to argue performatively in front of one another, maybe even physically block one another from casting votes, talk in word salad during press conferences, maybe even get indicted on occasion. That's just a thing of beauty. Love to the local sports teams who usually struggle with good decision-making and overall success. You know something? We got your back. Love to the city's finances, amazingly always in crisis, despite the friendly tax bills that go out in the mail. And special shout out to the parking enforcement crew, who knows just how much time you have left on your parking meter and times it out perfectly to make sure that a delightful orange piece of paper is left behind under your windshield wiper when you get back to your car. Mwah. Also, extra special smooches for the company that's getting rich off the city's parking meters. Okay, look, I'm not trying to be cynical here. This is just a reminder that we have some things to work through. But we are seriously lucky to be here. And we do have much to celebrate. I mean, there's Lake Michigan. It's the crown jewel of the Midwest. And on this show today, we learn about some exciting new research about our water supply. And we'll also actually celebrate love and inclusivity by learning about a local production company with an inclusive mission, and they have a pro-Valentine's Day event coming up. Are you working from home these days? You gotta love that. We learn about a new report that tells us who is working from home and where in the state of Illinois. Hey, I love you. Recently, it was announced that the Illinois Institute of Technology is part of a six-state collaboration called Great Lakes Renew. This collaboration was awarded $160 million over 10 years from the U.S. National Science Foundation to develop and grow a water-focused innovation engine. The lead researcher for IIT on the project is David Lampert. He is an assistant professor of civil and environmental engineering at the Illinois Institute of Technology, and he is here with us today on Outside the Loop. Dave, nice to talk to you. Welcome.
Thanks for inviting me. Happy to be here.
You're quite welcome. Great to have you here. So, all right, the first question I have here is, what is this water-focused innovation engine? What is this going to be? What's the plan here?
Yeah, so this is the Great Lakes Water Innovation Engine, and the basic idea is to advance our capacity for innovations in the circular water economy through a combination of researching water problems, developing technologies, and translating those technologies into the workforce, and then doing workforce development activities around the, you know, the big idea to take away is waste to wealth and health. So we're going to start with like waste that might be in water. We're going to try to recapture those things that are there that might be valuable. And we're going to try to make sure that the water is safe and healthy for people.
Yes. Yeah, so as I understand it here, you are looking in part at wastewater. Why are you focusing here? Tell us what you're looking at.
There's so many different dimensions to wastewater. You know, wastewater is a term that maybe we'd like to use other ways to describe it, because there are lots of things that are in wastewater that could be valuable. There's a lot of ongoing research at trying to capture energy from wastewater. There are valuable minerals that are present in wastewater that we could use for things like battery development and other critical elements. And so we're trying to get beyond the idea of wastewater and think about those as a way to create prosperity. For me personally, I have done some work with wastewater and looking at strategies to remove particular kinds of pollutants so that the water is safe. And then I've also done work looking at trying to reduce the energy costs of wastewater. So we spend like about 1% of all the electricity in the U.S. on treating wastewater, and trying to turn that around is a part of the research that I do.
So there is some value when we use the term wastewater. I think there's a lot of colorful imagery that maybe comes to our minds. But you're saying here that there is some value in that wastewater, and you're looking at how to extract that. What is an example of that? What can we learn from wastewater? What can we get out of it?
So first of all, I guess wastewater is still like a really broad term. So there's wastewater from like municipal wastewater, that is things that we send down the drain into the sewer system. And then there's also wastewater from industrial processes. And then there's other wastewater that happens from, say, mining activities. And I know in particular, I was formerly a faculty member at Oklahoma, and we did a lot of work there looking at wastewater from oil and gas that had a lot of potential for capturing things like lithium and other rare earth elements that could be used in batteries. So that would be like one example of things that are present in wastewater that could be useful. With municipal wastewater, there's a lot of interest, again, in trying to capture the energy. So there's a lot of food that goes down the drain, and that's a sort of form of energy that we can use with certain kinds of processes to generate natural gas from in a more sustainable way, for an example.
You know, you mentioned your work in Oklahoma with looking at industry and water, and I just can't help but think, driving east, you're going on the Skyway, you're driving through Gary, Indiana, and that's a town that has lots of industry. And it has for a long time. And a lot of those refineries and factories are very close to Lake Michigan. And I know that it's a concern about our drinking water, which comes from Lake Michigan. And I think that sometimes there might be a little bit of a tension between industry and the environment, in this case, the water. So that always just comes to my mind when I think about something like this. So do you think that maybe what you're doing here, this research, we could potentially find a way to have industry preserve that to a degree, but not harm humanity as much? Is that kind of what we're getting at here?
That is a perfect characterization of what this is all about. The Great Lakes are a national treasure, and they're such a key part of Chicago's history, both as a source of transportation and then also for industrial development in the past. And as you said, in the past, we've had tension between the water and the pollution that's been associated with industries. And what we're hoping to do here is to bridge that divide and try to think about how we can look at the Great Lakes as a resource to bring industries back, but make sure that when those industrial activities are taking place, that we're doing it in a way that's sustainable.
Another thing here that you're looking at, which I think is interesting and timely, especially over the last few months, you're researching stormwater infrastructure and the inequities that exist when it comes to stormwater infrastructure in Chicago. So when we look at that topic, what does that mean specifically?
In Chicago, we have stormwater infrastructure, and when the word stormwater is used, that refers to runoff that happens in cities from rainfall. So that's, you know, different than wastewater, which would be something that was water that was taken and used. So stormwater just refers to the runoff that happens on land, and we have a very complicated system of sewer networks that we use to manage the stormwater. And there are issues. I have a basement. I'm making this call from a basement right now. There are lots of issues with water backing up into basements around here because the city is pretty flat and near the lake. And so what we're trying to do in this project is to just look at strategies to decrease the chances of basement backups and pollution that gets associated with that going into waterways. And then we're trying to look at this also from an equity perspective, like you mentioned. From our preliminary investigations indicate that there tend to be more problems in lower income areas. That doesn't necessarily mean that there's a deliberate attempt to cause these problems in lower income areas, so there's a little bit of a challenge there in figuring out cause and effect. But we feel like in general that at least in lower income areas that there are more of these problems with basement backups and water on the streets and other places. And so we're just trying to understand better why that's happening and try to think about ways that we could get better outcomes for all the people of the city.
So water is your thing here. You are researching water, and you have been for a while. In this region, in Chicagoland, just in general, I think a lot of us still try to filter our water through refrigerators or Brita filters or what have you. How are we doing overall when it comes to our drinking water here in Chicago and Chicagoland? I know we're sitting next to this lake, Lake Michigan, and we're pumping that out, but how are we doing here with our water?
Well, I know a lot of people use water filters at home, and I'm someone who doesn't, because I trust in the water that we're doing a good job treating it and that it's safe. You know, the EPA has lots of standards that are required from any sort of a public water system, and I know that Chicago works really hard to make sure that we're meeting those standards and that the water is safe to drink. And so I personally always make sure that I drink water straight out of the tap, just as my way of kind of advertising that's one of our products that we believe in. Yeah.
Well, there you go. All right. I'll take that. I'm confident now that you've said that. Drink it out of the tap. But look, what you're doing here is, I think it's important. A lot of applications that can be used when it comes to your research. And I know there's a lot of people involved in this collaboration, and you've been working on this for a long time and in some capacity. So we could all check out greatlakesrenew.org. And this is a fascinating thing that you're doing. So keep doing what you're doing. David Lampert, Assistant Professor of Civil and Environmental Engineering at the Illinois Institute of Technology and the lead researcher for IIT on the Great Lakes Renew Initiative. David, thank you so much for talking to us today.
Thanks very much for having me.
As a result of the COVID-19 pandemic, many of us started working remotely. And working from home became a common practice, a practice that still exists to some degree today. The Institute of Government and Public Affairs at the University of Illinois released a report this week that focuses on our state called Working from Home in Illinois, Who Can and Does. One of the authors of this report is David Merriman. He's also the interim director of the Institute of Government and Public Affairs at U of I, and he is here with us today on Outside the Loop. David, nice to talk to you again. How are you?
Good. Nice to talk to you. I'm fine. Thank you.
You got it. So let's talk about this report here. Why did you decide to study working from home in Illinois?
You know, during the pandemic, we all very much experienced it in person. We went through, you know, a very dramatic change at the university, and I'm sure in many other places, where we went from virtually 100% in the office to virtually 100% at home. And then as the pandemic kind of became less intense, we gradually moved back to working, you know, partly in the office. But I was just fascinated. I think all of us were just fascinated by, you know, the fact that this was possible. And we wondered what it was doing, you know, how common it was and what might happen to productivity and where it was going in the long run. And we thought that there were all kinds of potential public policy implications for it. You know, most notably, the transportation, public transit has been greatly changed. There's a lot less people on it on some days of the week. We think that, you know, downtown office commercial space is much less occupied. And we thought there were just like a lot of possibilities for public policy implications. We really just wanted to start by understanding what was happening before public policy decisions were made without good evidence.
So it's interesting here because your report is extensive. There's a lot in here. But in terms of who is actually working from home today, can you generally paint a picture of that person when it comes to things like income, geographic location in the state or occupation, things like that? Who is working from home?
Yeah, I mean, I think the basic results aren't terribly surprising. The people who are most likely to be working from home are people who work in management, business, science, and the arts. So they're generally highly educated. They generally are doing kind of office jobs, very problem-solving type jobs. They're also generally highly paid, and they're also more urbanized. We found there wasn't much difference between men and women, the likelihood that they would work from home. And we did find that in some less urban areas, there's still a significant number of people that are working from home.
And, you know, it's interesting because I think that we hear that, and you're right, maybe we're not surprised by that information, the data in the report, but I think it also is part of the conversation where we have to mention that those folks who are maybe working hourly or working retail, when the pandemic hit, they couldn't go into work, and many of them suffered. They couldn't get paid because if you're not showing up at the register, you're not getting paid, but no one's showing up in the store. So when we think about this, you said higher income people tend to work from home, but the impact conversely is then those who are not as high of income statistically, maybe work hourly jobs, the negative impact could be higher there. Is that right?
Yeah. Well, I mean, I don't think there's a negative. The pandemic certainly had a, you know, it was very rough on in terms of employment, particularly on low wage workers and the kind of workers that you describe. Of course, we had government policy that in the end, actually, many of those people came out really quite well and were got sufficient government aid to actually more than cover what they lost on average. I think now in the sort of, I don't quite want to say post-pandemic because certainly COVID is out there and around, but right now, many of those jobs of the sort of lower paid jobs or even some relatively high paid jobs like construction, you know, their working place really hasn't changed. They're still working in person. So they've had kind of a neutral impact or very little impact in terms of the way that they work. So that's really the difference. We did find in the report, interestingly, that some people, even in the you know, the very low end of the income scale, we found a little bit of an increase in those people working at home. And that was somewhat surprising to us. We haven't had a chance to fully investigate it. We think some of those people might be working in things like call centers, where previously they had to go into a physical place, and now they're more likely to be working actually out of their homes.
You're saying that leads me into my next question here. There's a line in your report that says the feasibility of working from home does not necessarily match who does work from home. So does that mean that there are other considerations at play when it comes to working from home, like the employer giving the option of being able to work from home, or maybe some other factors at play here?
Right. So even in the category with the highest share of working from home, which is those occupations I mentioned before, really pretty highly educated, only about a third of the people in that category work from home, according to the data we have. You'll see some other studies that have it slightly higher. But even a lot of those people don't even work from home. And we don't really know why they don't work from home. I think there are a number of possibilities. One possibility is that the employer doesn't want them to work from home, so it's not giving them license to do it. I think other possibilities are, I certainly know people who you know, live in relatively small places, and they can't work from home because, you know, especially if it's a couple, they may not be able to both be at home at the same time and effectively work. Or they may have children at home, or they may just find it distracting. So we don't know completely whose choice it is. But even in the highest category of work from home in terms of occupations, only about a third of those people are working from home.
I know that this report, again, it's called Working from Home in Illinois, Who Can and Does, and we will link up to it through our channels. Your report's talking about, in one section here, the access to high-speed internet. And that is something, obviously, working from home requires some sort of internet connection because we're all working through our devices these days. What did your report find when it comes to access to high-speed internet across the state of Illinois?
We first of all found that, and then this was in 2021, 86% of the labor force had access to high-speed internet. So it's a very high percentage. And we found that in, even in rural areas where there's been more concern about that, there's high-speed internet. And we use the definition that the Federal Communications Commission recommended, so kind of the Federal Communications Commission definition. Virtually everybody that's working at home has access to high-speed internet. For the people that aren't working at home, we don't know really how, if the lack of high-speed internet is a factor in them not working at home. But we did find some increase in access to high-speed internet just over the past couple of years. I guess I should say one more thing is that when we say access to high-speed internet, our understanding is that that's sufficient for some uses, but not all. Even myself, I have to say that I have what would be considered high-speed internet at home, but I recently had a meeting where I had 15 people involved in it, and I had all of them have their cameras on. And I couldn't do it. You know, it didn't work.
Right,
so
right. There
are certainly limits to what you can do.
You know, I'm wondering if there's a way to measure this, and I have no idea, but I'm just spitballing here in terms of, okay, we're working at home. More people are doing it overall post pandemic. Is there a way to measure productivity when we look at the jobs here across when we're working from home?
We didn't do that, but we did look at some of the literature on productivity, and the results are very mixed. I'd say some of the early studies actually claimed that productivity was higher for people working at home, and there's some good studies that show that in particular cases where productivity was actually higher at home. Other studies have questioned that, and there's also the question of, even if you can measure productivity as going up from working from home, you know, over the long term, will that be maintained? How do you train new people? You often hear discussions about training people that are coming in? Is that hindered by them not working in the office? And you often hear discussions about whether there's lack of team morale. Mm-hmm. So I think that's very much an open question, and it's probably likely going to depend on the work situation. But it's certainly not clear that one way is always better than the other way.
So looking ahead here, David, you end your report and you're pretty much telling us that work from home is here to stay. So as you look ahead here with the data that you have found in this report, where are we going with this? It's here to stay. I mean, is it going to change? Is it going to grow? Do we know?
You know, that is very much an open question. I don't think I can really prognosticate on that. I can say we're never going back. I think it's pretty clear we're never going back to anything like the pre-pandemic age. You know, there's always going to be a significant number of people that are working from home. I feel, and I've been looking at various data, not only in our own report, I feel that we're settling down to something that's probably likely to be pretty stable, which means close to a third of work days will be not at the office, at least in the immediate future. I think that's where we're headed.
Wow. Well, this has a lot of repercussions for many other avenues in our society, and the conversation continues. But we can go to igpa.uillinois.edu to see this report called Working from Home in Illinois, Who Can and Does. The co-author of this report is David Merriman. He's also the interim director at the Institute of Government and Public Affairs at the University of Illinois. David, thank you so much for talking to us about this today, and we'll do it again soon.
Always a pleasure, Mike. Thank you.
Valentine's Day is almost here and love is in the air. There's a lovely event coming up in just a few days, Valentine's Day on Wednesday, that celebrates love and inclusion. It's the LGBTQ soiree being held at the IO Theater at 1501 North Kingsbury Street in Chicago. It's from 6 to 11 p.m. The host of this event is Chicago-based production company Second Glance Productions. Anthony Williams is the founder of Second Glance Productions, and he's here with us today on Outside the Loop. Anthony, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
Oh, you're quite welcome. It's great to have you here. So we'll talk about the event coming up on Valentine's Day in just a moment here. But first, let's talk about your production company, Second Glance Productions. You started this in 2009. And this has a very unique mission to create spaces for underrepresented groups. Can you tell us why you started this particular company in 2009?
Absolutely. Yeah, I grew up in Little Rock, Arkansas. And so when I left Little Rock, I went to L.A. As an actor. I was strictly an actor, primarily only just an actor.
Sure.
And I moved out to the West Coast and just really realized there were not very much many opportunities that I could take advantage of as a person of color, especially a queer person of color. And so I was just getting a lot of feedback from those around me saying, more than likely, you'll have to develop your own projects. And so I ended up leaving L.A. and moved across the country to North Carolina, where I started my production company, and really just dove into writing and directing and producing and just, you know, developing my own projects with, you know, specific stories in mind that I knew that I wanted to tell or that I even wanted to see as a viewer.
And then how did you get to Chicago?
Oh, Chicago, my goodness. So I spent maybe like 10 years in North Carolina. And then it just felt like, you know, it was time to transition to something new. I developed quite a bit of projects, developed a lot of lovely relationships. But at that time, a lot of the work was moving to Atlanta. And I had pretty much was born and raised and lived in the South for the majority of my life and really wanted to experience something different. So I considered Atlanta, but to me, it was still the South. Didn't really want to go back to LA at that time, and New York was way too expensive for my pocketbook.
Yeah.
So I was like, well, Chicago is, you know, a great spot to to go. And so I visited for a few years, a couple, you know, times at a couple visits at a time, and really decided like this really felt like home. It was really more of a sense of community here within the arts community, through theater, all the way to film, to, you know, music, to everything. And it felt like everybody kind of knew everyone, yeah, which is a sense that I didn't get on the West Coast. And so, I think that really sealed the deal for getting me here to Chicago, probably like late 2018, early 2019.
Hmm. You know, it is the biggest small town, you know, when you get like, when you think about this, people are doing their own thing, but it seems like, boy, yeah, I know that person that was doing that one project. Oh yeah, we've worked together on something. So I agree with you. It's such a great feeling here. You know, doing what you do, your production company really focuses on work that does explore, you know, groups that have not been as represented as others. And talking about diversity here and representation, I'm curious what you think about where we are today when we talk about film and media in 2024, because that word diversity is kind of thrown around a lot. And now for some reason, people say it's a bad word, but whatever.
Yeah, sure.
But where are we with this diversity in representation when it comes to film and media?
In my opinion, I feel like we've made great strides, but of course we're not where we need to be. And I say that because there is more representation on screen now than there was 10 years ago. You know, you've got more leading men and women of color, you know, from Asian to Latino to, you know, African-American. There's just so much more representation. But however, you know, in the industry, there's still not representation or equality when it comes to pay. And so I feel as if, you know, once we take one step forward in one thing, but, you know, there's still many steps to go in other areas. And so I think, you know, that we've made some great strides for, you know, the industry as a whole. But I feel like as if there's so much more, and know that there is so much more that we could do. And that's one thing that we try to focus on with Second Glance, is creating those opportunities, not only just by representation on screen, but behind the camera as well. Representation in gender and color and pay equity and, you know, all across the board, because it is important. You know, we all have lives to live. We all have families to feed, but we also, you know, have a story that we want to tell and an art that, you know, that we feed off of. And so to be able to make a fair living, not necessarily a decent living, but a fair living, being able to do what you do, we still have many strides to go in that area.
And in this industry that we're talking about here, it is an industry that, you know, it's entertainment. So it's about storytelling. And, you know, if you're not seeing or hearing the stories about you, about the group that you can identify with, that's really frustrating and, you know, kind of isolating, I think, be it gender, be it religion, be it, you know, race. If you're not telling these diverse stories, then really people are going to feel left out. And if we're really talking about celebrating everyone, it's important to kind of broaden our horizons here.
You're absolutely correct. Like, and that's the standpoint that I have when it comes to all media, is that we have to be able to find ways to represent everyone. We're all unique. We all have different intersections in our lives that make us who we are. And to be able to share those stories with other people, you know, could be a blessing in somebody else's life and we don't know, you know, a blessing in disguise, you know, in somebody else's life. And we don't know until we put it out there. And, you know, that's kind of the approach that I took with my first feature film that I did called Thicker Than Blood. That movie meets at the intersections of Black voices, people who are a part of the LGBT community, people who are living with HIV, and faith, which is not necessarily, you know, a lot of intersections that you find in film. And so to be able to find, you know, ways to tell all of those stories, to be able to show, you know, the different facets of different cultures and communities and ways of living, it's more important than I could probably put into words.
So let's talk about this event that's coming up on Valentine's Day. It's the LGBTQ Soiree at the IO Theater in Chicago. Tell us about what's coming up here.
So the LGBT Cupid Soiree is presented by us at Second Glance Productions, and it's sponsored by Impulse Group Chicago. It really piggybacked off of the latest project that we've developed. It is a queer dating docuseries, and it's a proof of concept for a new queer dating docuseries, I should say, rather. Mm-hmm. And it's called It's Not You, It's Me. And it follows three bachelors of color as they decide to get back into dating. And so that leads over into the LGBTQ patoire, because we will be premiering that trailer for the proof of concept at that event. But more than just, you know, that project, we will also be having featuring a new we'll be featuring a new improv comedy show that's like half improv, but also half queer speed dating on stage in front of an audience. So I saw this really awesome show in Los Angeles called Dating Game, G-A-Y-M-E.
I see.
And it's hosted by this amazing lesbian couple who get people who are looking for love to sign up to be brought on stage. And so they facilitate a speed date on stage in front of a live audience. All the while, there are improv actors in the audience listening and picking up tidbits of information from these dates happening on stage. So when the dates are done, the improv actors get up and they perform improv comedy based on the dates that they just saw. And it was hysterical. And so this will be the first time that they leave LA to go to premiere the show anywhere else. So it's a Chicago premiere for this show for Valentine's Day. And then we have another outside element that we are bringing in for the community to be able to participate in speed dating. And it's not your traditional speed dating that you would think of, but it is, you know, 2-minute lightning speed dating rounds, but we are facilitating it in a way that fosters genuine connection as well as starts conversation. So you get to know a person on a deeper level, hopefully within 2 minutes.
The Soiree, it's coming up on Valentine's Day at the IO Theater, 1501 North Kinsbury Street in Chicago, from 6 to 11 p.m. It is being hosted by locally based production company Second Glance Productions, and Anthony Williams is the founder of that company. Check out secondglanceproductions.com. Anthony, this sounds like a lot of fun on Wednesday, and really congrats on all of the work that you've been doing over the years, and keep doing what you're doing. It's really important. Thanks for talking today.
Yeah, thanks for having me on. I appreciate it.
And that just about does it. Outside the Loop, show number 904 is done. Thank you, as always, for listening to the show this week. I appreciate it. Thanks to Bob Ferguson for all of his great engineering work in the studio. I hope you have a wonderful week, and I will talk to you again next time right here on Outside the Loop.